I'm Pablo with Race to Walk, and these are just some thoughts on a Sunday. And I'm actually doing this on the go today, and I started doing this once live, which I normally do, but my iPad overheated and it just shut off, and I think the stream was still going, so I forgot about that. I haven't tried to do something in my car for a while, so totally forgot that that's a possibility. So right now I'm just recording this, and because if I have to do this in pieces, I don't want to have to keep redoing it. So what this is I do weekly updates and just share a few thoughts, and then also give an update about where we are in helping some Afghan Christians who are trying to escape the Taliban. And I know that sounds like a crazy collection of words there, and it kind of is, but I got involved in this because people always ask, like, how did this even start? How did this happen? My friend Mark Ritchie was teaching some Afghans a Bible study for them. He had met them through Pakistani pastors he had been working with. He's been doing a Bible study ministry there since 2020. And after the fall of Kabul and Afghanistan, there were a lot of Afghans that escaped to Pakistan. And so anyway, that's kind of how it started in October 22. I filled in for him in those classes, and there were some questions about what to do about visas and just to stay in Pakistan so they didn't get deported. And that led into a whole other dimension of what we were doing there. So that's been an experience learning about not only what's going on in Pakistan, but just international relations as a whole, and learning about immigration. It's just been a crash course. Mark's friend Don Shire joined in with us. He has a ministry, Don Shire Ministries, at donshireministries.org, and he said that he would partner with us with his ministry, so that any donations made at donshireministries.org, if you select Race to Walk, it will go towards this effort. Because not only is it a little challenging getting that money there sometimes, but kind of need a structure, like when you're sending money over to Pakistan and Afghanistan, because you don't really want the not only the IRS to question it, but also, you know, the Department of Homeland Security. That's the last thing you need is problems there. So Don keeps us all straight. I tell him what we need, and provide him documentation, and then he sends it over. So anyway, that is what we're doing. And I can't tell you exactly what we do because it kind of changes. Circumstances change. There's different needs that come up, and so we just are just kind of trying to move forward and move them closer to immigration. So this is what we're doing. But the title of this chat today is Talk as Sheep, because a lot of times people want to be known as a certain thing or a certain positive characteristic, but they don't want to do the work or make the hard choices that make those labels appropriate. And the first time I did a stream, I went off on a long thing about one of our shady school board members, who's now our state rep, or a state rep, and his insistent on calling himself doctor because of he received an honorary degree from this pop-up university that just tossed out 10 of them at the same time. It's completely ridiculous. But, you know, he wanted the title without, you know, the trouble and the tribulation to get it. And that's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. Not only is it show a lack of integrity, try to present yourself as something that you're not, but it's also an insult to the people who have done the work. And it was especially disgusting when that school district does not even honor and respect advanced degrees themselves. It's very obvious they pay $1,000 more for a master's degree, like if you're teaching, or at the end, $1,000 more per year for a doctorate. So they don't respect it. And he's made it abundantly clear by just saying, oh yeah, I'm just gonna call myself doctor based on this. So Anyway, I think we have problems with that too. Like, and with the U.S., we want to sound like we're better than we are. You know, there's a whole thing, you know, with the boogeyman CRT and not wanting to acknowledge our actual history. It's not just that. It's just what we're doing today. We want to act like we're one of the good guys. We're the good nation. When we're doing some, we are doing currently some shady things. I've talked a couple times in the other updates that there's plenty of evidence that the CIA is working with the Taliban. And it's not just what the Taliban prisoners that Trump released as part of the Doha agreement. He released 5,000. It's also they've released some recently. So this is what we are doing. It's not just what we've done in the past. You can't keep acting crappy and be considered the good guy. That's not the way it works. That's not the way it works. But this is what we're trying to do. We do this personally, like our state rep that wanted to be known as a doctor, but it was only, that's the thing. I don't think he does this now. It was only during that year. It was a crazy thing. He insisted on it. He insisted on being called doctor. Somebody filed a complaint against him and the district hired an attorney. We have counsel for the district, but they hired an attorney to defend his right to call himself doctor off of an honorary degree, which you don't. It's the lamest thing ever. And then they had it up on the website, and you would think that if it's a educational institution is saying something like that, you wouldn't even think to question it, right? Then he gets appointed to Humble City Council. So while he's being considered among other people for that city council position, he has on the school district website, it says Dr. Charles Cunningham. It's actually a crime to present yourself as having a degree. If you have a fictitious or substandard degree and you try to use that to get a job or to market in any way, it's actually a crime. It's a class B misdemeanor. And my opinion, presenting yourself as a doctor, as this authority figure, when you're really not, among this pool of candidates for consideration for appointment, I consider that marketing yourself with a substandard and fictitious degree. But anyway, has he ever been called to account for it? No. The school district, the taxpayers in the end paid to defend him to have that bogus title up. Once he got appointed the next year, he was no longer on the school board. They took it off his bio page. So it's now not up there anymore on the school district page, but it was. So anyway, just lame people. Just lame. If you want a title for something, you need to put in the time. I mentioned in the title of the video, Faith Without Works, and that comes from James chapter 2, verse 26, where James writes, faith without works is dead. And sometimes people read that and they think that's a contradiction with that we're saved by grace through faith, right? But it's not, because if you really believe something, if you truly believe it, then you are going to act in accordance with those beliefs. What we do is actually what we believe. So if our actions aren't in line with what we say we believe, then that's showing us that we really don't believe what we say we do. And so that is what faith without works is. It's James is saying, talk is cheap. You know, just show up and do the work and show what you believe. A lot of times with the Afghans, some people will say, oh, they're not really Christians. It's like, well, how would you know? How would you know what's in someone's heart or in their mind? And the only way you would know is by what they do. What is it that they do? Are they showing that they believe? And that's true for us too. Are we really acting in a way that's in line with what we say we believe? We had a discussion about that in Bible study today. I think the answer a lot of times is no. It's no. So anyway, I'm going to just go over a few updates about what's going on in Afghanistan. One of the first ones I wanted to share was, this is a story about a father who is trying to sell a kidney to help his daughter. She was given a scholarship to the University of Virginia in Lynchburg, and there's a full scholarship, which is absolutely amazing. I have several college students I'd love to find something like that for. But in order to be able to take advantage of it, and to be able just even to get to the U.S., she has to have a visa to fly into the U.S. The U.S. does not have an embassy in Afghanistan, so she can't fly directly from Afghanistan to the U.S. She has to get to a surrounding country where there is an embassy. And he's trying to get her to Pakistan. And it says in the article that the stated visa price is $8, but you probably won't get a visa for that amount. An expedited and guaranteed visa is $1,500 to go to Pakistan, and he wants to try to get her there. So he wants to sell a kidney, and the doctor's telling him, you know, there's might not even be a buyer for it. Even with that, that's uncertain. But that is the reality of life as a woman, and particularly as a woman in Afghanistan under the Taliban. You can't be outside. They can't go to school. You know, they can't be in commerce. They basically can't do anything. I shared stories last week of families marrying their daughters off like as young as 12 because they don't want the Taliban coming in and taking their daughters as third or fourth wives. So it's just a very, very miserable situation there. This is another story. This is a woman who was arrested. She's used to work for the Afghan Republic, and she was criticizing the Taliban on Facebook, and so they arrested her and her sisters. We have people in the same situation. They're not in jail, but people that used to work for the government that have spoken out. This one person used to be head of elections in a province in Afghanistan, and he was speaking out about the Taliban. I don't know if this is why, but he's the one that I shared a couple weeks ago that the applications for his children for passports, because they have to apply online, was wiped out of the system. So this is an update for SIGR, which I know what this is now. It's actually the Special Inspector General for the Afghanistan Reconstruction. They do quarterly reports. They're saying here that the majority of the Taliban's revenue collection, 58%, is driven by what they call indirect customs tax collected at the border crossings, or other words, it says a little bit later, it's illicit. And so what that means is, like, basically, if you have any money when you go to a border crossing, the Taliban will take it. They just steal it. They're thieves. This is another update making the point that it's easier to destroy than to build. And the Taliban are terrorists and thugs, and that's all they know how to do is destroy and terrorize people. And he writes, breaking a society is far easier than mending one. Chaos is cheaper to bring about than order. Spreading fear is easier than making people feel safe. And building is more difficult than destroying. And that's very true. And this is a thread from Twitter. I'll have this on the article on my website, but this is a really good overview of just the level of betrayal that the Afghan Republic went through, explaining what went down in August of 2021. And he writes, every single Afghan frontline soldier or officer I've spoken to has told me they were desperately short of ammunition, fuel, water, and other supplies during the decisive fighting in 2021. Why? Was choking off the Afghan forces also part of the Doha deal? I honestly believe that it was, because there's another article on The Intercept where it talks about kind of like the elite squads. They were saying that they started to be basically hung out to dry in August of 2020. So there was a setup so that the Afghan government couldn't hold it. At the point when the Afghan Republican Forces defense forces started to collapse in July through August 2021, many units had been fighting for weeks or months without meaningful resupply. They were not just short of ammunition, but forced to eat expired field rations and drink unsanitary water. There were many reasons why logistics got difficult, but blaming it all on corruption is a cop-out. The major problems began as a result of the Doha deal, which massively restricted Afghan forces' offensive operations, making it easy for the Taliban to cut off supply lines. As restrictions on the Afghan forces allowed the Taliban to cut off ground supply lines, they needed supply via air, but we had made the too small Afghan Air Force totally reliant on Western contractors for maintenance, which were also going away in the summer of 2021. So the Doha deal, and critically, the way it was executed, prevented the Afghans from keeping ground supply lines open and then also took away the key enablers they needed for air supply. The mind boggles. Were we actively trying to make the Afghan forces collapse? I think the answer is yes. I think it was. I do. With Afghan ground forces short on ammunition, literally starving, and facing the toughest battle of the war, Western air support was taken away too. This was critical because the Afghan army had been designed by us to rely on it rather than ground artillery. On top of this, the Doha deal provided a huge amount of political legitimacy to the Taliban and strongly signaled to the Afghan forces that their allies did not really believe in them any longer. It's almost as if we intentionally were trying to undermine their morale. The Taliban, meanwhile, were getting 5,000 of their most hardened fighters released from prison, many of them immediately starting fighting again. And as Western support for the Afghan government forces was drastically reduced, Pakistan's continued to loyally back the Taliban. Despite being hamstrung or sabotaged tactically, logistically, and politically, the Afghan security forces kept fighting and dying for their country through the summer of 2021 until the loss of a few key cities, often through bribery, caused a cascading collapse. Perhaps the most disturbing, even though triggered by the Doha deal, Western support for Afghan forces was restricted much more aggressively than the Doha deal actually required. It was a choice, not a requirement, to pull the rug out from under the Afghan Republic. Conversely, the Taliban broke many of the promises they made in the Doha deal, but the U.S. showed little interest in imposing costs on them for doing so. It seems Biden really didn't give a for what happened in Afghanistan. But even with everything stacked against them, many units kept fighting until the very end, when Ghani got on the helicopter and fled. He was paid to do that. He got a payoff and he left. They believed in a better Afghanistan, but were let down both by Afghanistan's allies and leaders. We should be ashamed of ourselves. And then on this one, not only did the ANSDF units at least try to keep fighting until the end, the U.S. government explicitly told the remaining ANSDF units not to resist the Taliban rush on Kabul. As Jay Hammond reported in his interview with General Habibullah Alzai, the last chief of the Afghan military, he scraped together like 40,000 guys and planned on fighting off the Taliban to the last man. So this is what they did. And we just like literally sabotaged them at every turn. It's just, and this is what we've done. This is what we've done. This is another comment by the same person. And they're just part of this discussion. The idea of leaving Afghanistan allowed the West to refocus. So this is the argument. Allowed the West to refocus on Russia and China is ludicrous. Leaving Afghanistan massively increased the geopolitical risk from Russia and China and led to war in Europe. So there's been a lot of people. If we had not pulled out of Afghanistan, that Putin would not have invaded Ukraine. I haven't had a chance to listen to this yet, but this is a podcast on the latest UN Security Council's report on the situation in Afghanistan. And there was another little excerpt that I got in a daily update that said that the U.S. is basically ignoring it. They're like, nope. We're just ignoring it. We're going to pretend like everything's fine and the Taliban is great. There's another story this week. Now, I'm going to link to the article on my website, but the article is actually in, I think, Arabic. But if you use Google Translate, you can read it. But there's a proposal of the Prime Minister of Uzbekistan to the Prime Minister of Russia regarding the creation of a multimodal transportation corridor of Belarus, Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan the route of the trade corridor on Russia and Uzbekistan opens the way to new promising markets. So markets between Afghanistan and Russia. Great job. Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. So other story that came out this week, there's been quite a few people promoting this, that the Biden administration is in talks with the Philippines to take SIV applicants to wait while their applications are processed. And supposedly this happened last May. So they had talked about this. This is going to be a possibility. And then it was kind of put on a stall because things got so much worse. And there was, they thought it was like a lot more dangerous to bring in Afghans. They thought there might be a spillover of violence. What do I have to say about that? It wasn't this article, but it was another one. The question was, well, why doesn't the U.S. take the people to the U.S. and wait to process, put them on a base there and then wait to go through it? Good question. Good question. The other suggestion was to have them go closer to surrounding countries. Some of them are there, but enough staff isn't there to be able to process them in any process their applications in any sort of reasonable amount of time. But I was talking to someone with was with an NGO that has worked in Afghanistan, and I was asking him, well, what's the deal? What's the stick? And he said that he thinks a lot of it's political. And he said that, like, as far as the Afghan Adjustment Act, and that's basically just giving a path for people who are already here for citizenship, what they're saying is they have security concerns. And he said it's really not a valid concern because there was a lot of vetting that went into hiring the people to begin with. So SIV applications are for people who either worked like as translators or directly for the U.S. government. And then there's other paths like a P1 and P2 path into the humanitarian parole program, which when they get here, then they have to then apply for asylum or some other path. But there was a lot of vetting and a lot of security checks that were in place before they were hired. So we have two families that worked on some space project for a U.S. contractor. They all went through vetting and checks before they got hired. So the claim that people are concerned about checks is just, it's not valid. It's just an excuse. And people would just think about that logically. I think we would see how kind of a ridiculous statement that is. You let people be with your troops, in with them, and then you're not sure about the security of that person or where their loyalties are. That's ridiculous. So here's the thing. This isn't new. The way we're treating the Afghans is actually not new. We've done this a lot, and we've always been a little resistant, sometimes a lot resistant, to taking in refugees and people in need. Another example of the same sort of mindset and attitude was how we treated Jewish refugees during 1938 and 1941, when they were fleeing Nazis in Germany. And I'm going to link to this article, but we did the same sort of things there. There were all these people fleeing from like Germany and Austria, but the U.S. as well as other nations wouldn't change their immigration policy to meet the needs. I mean, they saw it, but they wouldn't change anything. So in November of 1938, the Nazis kind of went their intents known against the German Jews, and they burned like synagogues and ransacked businesses and arrested 30,000 Jewish men and boys and sent them to concentration camps. And German newspapers put out that the violence had been spontaneous, but it was obvious that it was part of a plan. The world felt bad. They said, oh, that's horrible, and including President Roosevelt. But in spite of that, he still did not do anything to accommodate the people that needed to flee that oppression. And he didn't ask Congress to change the quota system or the number of the quota and the limits on immigration. When I was reading through this, it was so similar to what the Afghans are facing right now. As the war went on, things got more intense, and the backup to get a visa to the United States was years and years long. And in order to be able to do that, they had to collect a bunch of different documents, and sometimes it had to be in a particular order. It's totally what this is like, especially that SIV application process. Instead of making it easier, since 2021, they've added more things and more requirements that people have to do. So when they're saying they're trying to speed things up, that's not true. They point out the documents can be expensive and they had expiration dates. Exactly. This is exactly the same thing. And they also had to have an American sponsor so they wouldn't be a burden on the U.S. Then on top of that, they had to be able to pay for a trip themselves to come over. And during wartime, those passages were very limited because there was a war going on. So this made things even more difficult for people to escape. And I didn't know this until I was just reading it, but there was a Wagner-Rogers bill that was going to accept 20,000 German refugee children under the age of 14 to the United States outside of those immigration limits. Jewish children would be the main beneficiaries, but the sponsors of the bill stressed that other children of other faiths would be part of it as well. Eleanor Roosevelt backed it, but people were protesting against it because they thought that, you know, those children would take resources and later take up jobs that would go to American children. And so it's the same thing. It's just this very xenophobic attitude. It's like, I have mine and forget everybody else. This last part on here, it's like the St. Louis, it was a ship that had 937 passengers escaping from Nazi Germany, and they had gotten landing certificates to go to Cuba, and they were just going to wait out until their immigration to the U.S. could be processed. When they got to Cuba, they found out that the documents were fake. This actually, something similar happened to some Afghan refugees going to Canada. They were given some letters of, I can't remember what it was. I was trying to find it, an article about it. They got these letters from a Canadian official, and they were supposed to be valid, but they wouldn't let them in. And I guess the landing certificates in Cuba for the Jews were not valid. And so Cuba made them leave. And they went to the U.S. and tried to gain entry there. They were turned back. They went to Canada. They were turned away. And so they had to go back to Europe. And the Jewish Congress came together and was trying to find a way for them to go someplace rather than going back to Germany. And they had to basically, you know, pay for a spot for asylum. And there was something like 230, almost a quarter of them, they weren't able, you know, to find enough spots. And they went back to Nazi Germany and they were killed in the Holocaust. But they had to try to find a way, right? And that's what the guy that I shared that had basically created a resettlement program and a resettlement system for just to be able to take care of his former employees and move them to Brazil. He said that was the only door that was open to them that he could find. And it's the same thing as when the Jews were trying to escape the Holocaust. It's like they saw it was, the world saw what was going on. They thought it was horrible, but they wouldn't do anything about it. So, other news. This is just annoying. This is an article that came out this week. Afghan refugee crackdown continues in Pakistan despite Taliban objections. This is another example of complete and total propaganda. Yes, it is true that Pakistan is cracking down on and continuing to on Afghan refugees. The person in our group that was arrested in jail for like 2 days last week, that's what they did. They were going door to door in the houses. He was coming back to his home. They stopped him, asked for his passport and visa, and he said, "It's in my room. Let me go get it." And they wouldn't let him, and they took him to jail. He was there until a friend brought his passport and visa to him, and then they let him go. And he actually has a valid passport and a valid visa to stay there. As this article reports, they're also arresting people with the UNHCR certificates, which they should not have to worry about that at all. But what is so incredibly bogus here is that the Voice of America is saying that the Taliban is telling Pakistan to back off. That's a bunch of baloney. And as I shared before, Voice of America was started to combat Nazi propaganda. Now they're putting out propaganda themselves to cover for the Taliban. The Taliban in Pakistan are working in coordination to deport people back to Afghanistan that used to work for the Afghan government. Don't even. That's just total propaganda. We are not the only people that are bailing on a responsibility. This is another story about a Canadian officer that's trying to get his people that were granted visas to come to Canada before the Taliban even took over, still haven't been able to make it through. And this is another story about the UK where, you know, they had people that work for them and they just bailed. It's the story here over and over and over again. So many people that I'm in contact with had, you know, worked for, you know, the governments or NGOs, like government agencies, like for the US, for Canada, for Germany, for Italy, for South Korea, all these countries. And then once NATO pulls out, it's basically they ghost them. There's no contact. So this last thing I want to share, this is actually a post on the community tab for Midas Touch. And it's talking about, you know, that they had the tanker caught on fire up on I-95 in Pennsylvania. Projection was that it was going to be under construction for 6 months. So the governor went and set up cameras so that people could watch the reconstruction of it. And between him and Biden, they worked away and Biden's providing support. And they're going to get it done in 2 weeks. So was going to take 6 months, now it's going to take 2 weeks. That's awesome. That's awesome. But this is the thing. This just shows we can get things done when we want to. So saying that things just take long, the only reason that immigration takes long is because we want it to take long and we are resist people coming in. That's the only reason. It doesn't have to take that long. We can get things done when we want to get things done. As far as our people, where we're at, I have to say it's kind of the same. It's kind of like been going back and forth between like managing crises, you know, something happens, there's an emergency, trying to manage that, and then trying to find and move a path forward. And it just takes so much time, you know, to make the phone calls because it's not just one, you know, you have to make several phone calls and explain it and the discussion. And it all takes time. And sometimes it just, like right now, it just seems like slow moving. But I just have to keep reminding myself just to keep moving forward and just keep putting out emails and making phone calls and continuing to ask. And one of the things that was kind of cool this week was, this part wasn't cool, but someone that came into our group, he's somebody that has been told he's going to be relocated to the UK through UNHCR, but they haven't yet. And he has an SIV application in that is pending. He was an attorney for the Afghan government. He has special passports that are expiring, or probably expired by now. And anyway, they've been there, and you know, they were told originally that it would take 12 to 18 months before people would start being moved for some of those paths. It should not, that was for the P1, P2 applications going to humanitarian parole. And they're still there and hardly anybody's moved. And so now they're there. They're under all this pressure by Pakistan to kick them out. And, you know, their whatever savings they had for most of them is gone. And they got evicted from their home where they were staying. And so I sent a message to our people, one of the pastors of our house church, and then a lady that basically works kind of like as a property agent. It's an Afghan. It's in the same sort of situation. It's not like they are in a much better position either, but they're willing to help. And so that was a cool thing. The other thing is the kids that I work with, I read with them. That's what I do. I read with them. Actually, just once a week. I used to do twice a week, but one of the people that has been helping with this that I brought in, she used to just work with them on the weekend and sometimes some other days. And I guess she has some more time now, the summer. And so usually I would meet with them on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I was told last week I just need to meet with them on Thursday this week because Kate was going to be meeting with them in my time slot. So I'm like, okay, they like her better. It's totally fine. It's totally fine. I mean, they're actual teachers. My friend Leslie too, I took Hebrew classes from her. I actually put her contact information if you want to learn Hebrew. She can teach via Zoom, but she works with them on Saturday. And I tell her, Leslie, they like you better than me because the dad, he's coming to a couple of my classes, but he never comes in anymore. He never misses one of Leslie's classes. I told her he just likes you better. So anyway, you have another person that actually it was a contact through an unexpected journal. She lives in Australia. She's meeting with them too. So anyway, I have some help there. So there was a contest, an essay contest by the Goy Foundation, and it was for children and youth, and the deadline was June 15th, and the topic was What is Peace? That was really interesting to read their thoughts, and I always try to keep in mind the situation that they're in, but sometimes it's hard because it's just things that I take for granted. It's not something that is just they have at their fingertips, right? And even when I'm talking to people that are coming in, you know, like especially working with the kids, I usually try to prep them a little bit so they know the circumstances that the kids are living in. And so they are honestly in a little bit better position than most of the Afghans that we're working with. They have family that are in Western countries that can help them some, but still there's a brother and a sister that are living together with their families there. So there's, let's see, 6-9 people in an apartment. Electricity isn't always on. Internet goes out. The kids haven't been in school since the pandemic started. They eat one meal a day and they just have their phones to work on things with. And, you know, I know they just have their phones, but I didn't think that even like using Google Docs was going to be difficult, but it was. Like the 17-year-old, he said his phone was old and he couldn't open up Google Docs. And so all of that was a little, I don't know, things that would be easy to do just aren't necessarily when you're in that kind of situation. So it was interesting. So keep them all in your prayers. And again, if you'd like to help out our people, you can go to DonshireMinistries.org and select Raise to Walk and donate there. If you have people that you know and would like to help, one way you can do that, if you would like to help them keep their phones online, is to go to mobilerecharge.com. And all you need is a person's phone number and their carrier, and you can add data to their phone. So the other thing, I don't think I've shared this, but I came across this about a month ago. This is basically kind of like a gig site for Afghans. So Afghans can register for different skills. And then if you'd like to hire somebody, you can go there. But if you need people, let me know, because I have a lot of people, very skilled people, especially if you need anything translated to from Persian, Farsi, Dari, or Urdu, let me know. Oh, Pashto as well. I don't have that up there. I have people that speak Pashto as well. So if you need translation services for anything, send me an email at contact@raisetowalk, and I can hook you up with them because they are there and they are looking for things to do. So the other thing is, I've talked several times about how dire the food situation is there. I'm just going to talk about a seal. It is an app you can download on your phone, and there's two sides to it. There is the first one is Do Good, which is you can buy food packages and send it to a particular person if you know them, or if you just want to donate a food package, they can assign it to someone. And then there's also the other part of it is kind of like an Etsy for Afghans. You can help family support themselves by buying one of the products. You can buy from artisans in Afghanistan as well as Turkey. It expanded there. But as I mentioned before, I've heard mixed reviews on the food distribution for Aseel. And I talked to Beth Raley at the Afghanistan Project podcast, and she said that she's been using Aseel for over a year to send food to an SIV family, and she's had no problems with it, and it's worked out really well. I talked to my friend Clint, who, if you want to follow him on Twitter, he's a good person to get some of the latest news of what's going on there. He does not like Aseel at all. Cannot stand it. He's had very bad experiences with it. He's not recommended at all. So there's that. He sends money to somebody that works with just basically humanitarian aid there, and she buys the food and sends it. But if you want information on that, if you need your food there, then let me know. It's just send me an email to contact@racewalk.org. That's how you can help some people that are in need in Afghanistan at the moment. If you would like to help them in their immigration journey, phase two of Welcome Corps is going to be opening up, I think, any day. I hope any day. But what Welcome Corps is another immigration path where private individuals can sponsor a refugee family during the 90-day resettlement period. And so they go through all these checks and screenings. What the sponsor group does is basically help the refugee family during that 90-day placement period. And so the requirements are there has to be a group of five individuals, or it can be an organization or a group. There has to be a team lead, and that team lead has to fill out a welcome plan about how they're going to help them. All of the people in the group that are going to be sponsoring have to go through a background check, and they're required to raise $2,375 for each person that is in the refugee family. And what that does is just kind of help them with that initial launch before the money from USRAP kicks in, and the sponsor group goes and picks them up at the airport, helps them get their kids registered in school, shows them around the neighborhood, basically, you know, just being a friend. We are hoping that this will be an option for some of our people, that, and I'm hoping it will be a little more speedy than the existing plans. That's what I'm hoping. So we'll just see how all of this works. If you have any questions about that, just send me an email at contact@racewalk.org. Again, just keep us all in your prayers. Again, if you'd like to help our people directly, you can go to donshireministries.org and select Race to Walk. And that will help do some good in their lives. So anyway, thanks for watching, and I will see you next time.